You're listening to Red Nation Online.
Welcome to From the Black Hole, episode 63. On today's podcast, we are joined by University of Regina Cougar Women's Soccer Program head coach, Bob Maltman.
Philosophically on the, you know, developing you as a person,
right.
And are you a community-minded individual? We do a lot of things within our program that are very much community engaging, and we're very proud of those things. But that, for me, is only done to, again, promote our university, which is sort of the overriding philosophy that our president has shown in terms of those who serve and community involvement and engagement. So I think we're kind of meeting that goal of the university as a, you know, at the greater level above us. But it's also allowing women to realize that it's a bit humbling to go into a school and to see kids just sort of be so appreciative of you to come out and spend some time with them.
Right.
We've been to Mexico through this university and worked with schools and humanitarian stuff. That's my philosophy as a coach within our program, because if we're gauged solely on wins, losses, or number of championships that we win as an institution, then we will fail miserably, because, you know, we haven't done that yet. But if we can gauge success, and there was an interest, I can't remember where I saw it, but it was on the web somewhere, about the definition of what success is so wide-ranging,
mm-hmm.
that if Rob Gale, to go back to that story, can now take seven of his players who end up turning into becoming professional players, who in turn, because of that, become better national men's teams players,
right.
who in turn become a better program, then he was very successful.
Yeah, yeah.
Just because his team didn't qualify for the World Cup. Yes, that is not good. I mean, I'm not condoning that.
No,
but there's different measurements of what success really is. And if we can take a team to a, you know, even with maybe minimal, or not having the best quote-unquote squad available to us, and still be highly competitive and be maybe a chance here, a chance there away from getting a goal or tying a game or winning a game, then those are the moments that we fought all season as well with our team,
right.
where, you know, we hit seven posts or three crossbars and whatever the combination, we lose seven games by a goal.
Right.
We didn't win very many games. We didn't make playoffs. And that was our goal. Every team sets that as a goal. Every team that's trying to qualify for the World Cup doesn't go, wow, we're going to go and give it our best.
Yeah.
Everybody says before the ball's been kicked, we want to go and qualify for the World Cup. And then when we get there, well, we want to be into the medal rounds. And when we get there, well, we want to win it.
Right?
So the realities are such that in Canada West, I think we are more prepared to be able to play a longer period of time. I think that having met some of the schools from Quebec and, you know, Eastern Ontario, there are also schools there who are able to play indoors year-round. And so if the CIS said to universities, who would be interested in having an extended season, never mind about the money to pay for it, like, you know, that's a separate issue, but who would be interested? I would venture to say out of the 54 or 55 schools that have women's soccer across Canada, that I don't think there would be, I would venture to say that not all schools would put their hands up, but I would think that there would be, on the low side, probably 15 to 20 schools, and more than likely probably around 30, 35 schools that would say, that would be cool.
Yeah.
So then it could be more like what you see in the NCAA, where they have their season in conference games, which we have, but now you have an off season where you can sort of go and arrange games to play. We're going to go and play McGill, and we'll play maybe Montreal when we're down there. And maybe on the way home, we'll stop in Toronto and we'll play the U of T in their bubble.
Right.
And then we'll come home.
Yeah.
$1,000 per player for the plane trip.
Right.
On average of $150 a night for two or three to a room, so that's about $50 a player. Carrying a squad of 20, that's another $1,000, plus $20,000 on the plane flights, plus the coaches. The meals on average are about $35 a day per person, because I don't like to starve my players to death. And if you're down east, it's maybe a little bit more.
Wait, you mean they need food too?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you rapidly run the bill up.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the Canadian difference between the NCAA difference is the NCAA has two sports that fund everybody else. And everybody
right.
knows that.
Right, right, right.
They have football and they have basketball.
Yeah.
If an institution has neither one of those two sports, they probably aren't surviving very long.
Right.
And even within that framework, now look at how the complexities have risen in the States regarding a union of students, athletes now threatening to sue for professional status.
Right.
Athletes losing their eligibility because of promoters or boosters giving stuff under the table and being caught.
Right.
Athletes now, because of the money and the prestige, going to universities for 2 years just to meet the minimum requirement to enter into basketball or whatever it is, so I can go and become a multimillionaire, but barely able to read and write.
Right.
Are those what we want to be as a society? So, you know, to me, like, I'm not giving you an easy answer.
No, it's a good answer.
But those are all the parameters that I think Canada does need to see at the government level. How sincere are we in seeing the CIS as a primary venue to develop really top quality athletes in all sports?
Right.
And if the answer to that is very much so, then how can we then support that? Because that would maybe now then attract more athletes to stay locally. Not all.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the analogy when Honda first came in. Honda was a piece of shit car. It was like $2,500 purposely brought in, but then they asked the questions of the U.S. population, what needs to improve, and they did that. That's the Japanese way.
Right.
And now look at how popular Honda is.
Right.
So if the CIS, if the Canadian government...
I might have two in my garage
exactly,
right now.
Exactly. Yeah. So if the Canadian government asks the CIS, well, what do you feel you need to become the primary developer of elite-level athletes for our country? Maybe in specific sports, maybe in all. And that's also open to debate.
Right, right.
If they say, well, in order to do that, this is what we require, then if the government is unwilling to provide that, or there is no private organizations willing to step up to fund that, well, where is the money going to come from?
Yeah.
It comes from people like us as coaches doing fundraising, trying to find a way to generate the funds that we would like to generate, to be able to add to the money that the university already gives us to do the job that we know we need to do to be more competitive, better prepared, etc. And a lot of that falls back on the coaches. And I'm not bitter about that, I'm just the reality is that the university provides us with a good budget. They provide a full-time wage for me. They provide a budget for all of our travel costs in season. And they provide an expenditures budget, which isn't terrible, it's not great, but it's not bad. And that's to cover some recruitment phase, some maybe additional things that we want to add, some, you know, assistant coach payments, those type of things.
Right, right.
But it's nominal amounts.
Right.
Anything outside of that, so if we want to travel to the West Coast in the fall or in the winter, that's on the soccer team side. So now, if I want to take 20 players out there, 25 players out there, plus myself, my assistant coach, our trainer, and be there for 3 or 4 days and arrange 3 games, then we have to find, in net effect, probably close to $32,000 to make that happen. So now, again, you either go back to the well and say to that student-athlete who already perceives of paying a lot of money to go to school, oh, I need another $1,000.
Right.
Because then it's not about sometimes the best, it's the ones with the most money.
Right.
Those two are not always the same team.
You know, I've had discussions with friends of mine from Ontario whose kids are going into OPDL, and now it was $3,500 last year, and this year it's going to be $5,500, and they got two kids, and it's
and
like,
I
well,
think fundamentally,
kind of chokes off the pipeline.
It does, and it fundamentally, I swear, I've had these same discussions in Saskatchewan, is that we have a current debate going on within our media on a daily basis right now. We have had, in the last 15 years, maybe even longer, but definitely the last 15, you walk down the streets of anywhere in Regina or anywhere in Saskatchewan, in a major center, and even in smaller centers, the cultural change that you see just in terms of color of skin, where, you know, demographics, where they come from culturally, countries, has changed phenomenally.
Mm-hmm.
When I moved here in 95 from Saskatoon, I never saw an Ethiopian restaurant, I never saw an Afghani restaurant.
Yeah.
There was minimal sort of Middle Eastern restaurants.
Yeah.
It was very much Caucasian, it was very much Ukrainian, British, fish and chips, maybe some Italian stuff.
Right.
Now you see a great diversity, which I feel is the beauty of Canada. It's added to the fabric of our communities. It's brought in people with a refreshing approach, can-do attitude, an ability maybe to see an opportunity that we who have been here now for too long or have been here long enough maybe are either not interested in, have never thought about, don't see it as an opportunity, or aren't simply willing to do the work it takes to be successful.
Right.
East Indians, like the Pakistani, there's, you know, all those ethnic peoples have moved in now, and you can see, I think it's awesome to be able to go and open the Yelp or whatever and say, where are we going tonight if we want to go for supper? And it's not simply, no disrespect, because I love girls and the keg and different places, but isn't it nice now that you can go to a really good East Indian place if you want, or you can go to a nice Afghani restaurant, or go and have a nice latte at a kind of a Middle Eastern / Italian place. That to me is what really creates a fabric to. But many of those kids coming in, like we do a lot of work in Moose Jaw on a yearly basis with Prince Arthur School, and they have a high percentage of ESL kids in their classes coming from war-torn countries, big families. They all love the game.
Right.
But they can't afford
to go to university.
$50 a person.
Yeah.
They can't afford $1,000 for provincial, $2,000 for provincial. But yet, those are the kids that really we want to play because they all play and they all love the game.
Yeah.
And so Canada and the U.S., there was a really interesting article in, I saw it about 6 months ago, about the NCAA, or the, not the ODP, but it's a, excuse me right now. Oh my goodness. It's basically like the premier youth teams in the YSL, like the Youth Soccer League in Canada, in the U.S. where you've got these major clubs and travel all around.
I mean, PDL clubs?
Well, not the,
or
no, but
lower
the,
than
the,
that.
The youth levels. Like
oh, okay, okay,
the,
yeah, yeah.
The Super League and all.
USSDA.
The Super League, right?
Okay.
Well, you've got, they said, why is it we see so few African Americans playing on those teams?
Yeah.
Well, we can't be surprised.
Yeah.
And yet,
it costs a lot of money.
When you look at other sports, football, basketball, baseball, what percentage of African-American background do you see, or Mexican, or Cuban, Dominican Republic, Hispanic-speaking cultures, how many do you see playing in those sports?
Mm-hmm.
But yet you don't see the same representation in soccer, with the exception perhaps of L.A., places like that where there's a huge Mexican population,
right.
good domestic needs, and then you can just go and pick that kid, that kid, that kid. So we have to ask ourselves the question, for a sport that is supposedly so cheap to play, why all of a sudden has it become so goddamn expensive to play?
It is.
And how many players are we losing, just like hockey loses, gifted athletes who simply because of their financial resources and the pressures that we put parents under, to look at their kids in the eyes and say, which one of you can we afford to keep playing the sport?
Right.
And then to look at your other child and say, sorry, you're not it.
Yeah.
How does that work?
I mean, there are two very huge topics there. One is the whole pay-to-play situation in Canada, and the other one is the financial resource problem. I don't know another way to characterize it. I mean, it seems that soccer just doesn't have the resources that most other major sports
I don't think so. I think what we've done is, because I've heard this from my colleagues that I know, when I've said, like, why is there a provincial fee like $2,300 to play now for 2 weekends of training and then they go to an event? Like, what the hell is that for? Well, that's just the way it is in elite sports now. So all the elite sports decide to line up and jump off of the Hill Towers in downtown Regina. You're going to join them just because that's what the elite sports do.
Right.
And that's the stupidest. To me, it's a cop-out. I think there's partially funding. Partially it's, do we really need to have every single player in every single instance spend $300 for a nice tracksuit and training kit and all that goes with it? Or is it about maybe reducing the fee and saying, you know what we're going to do? You're going to get a $10 t-shirt, you're going to get a nice pair of shorts, you can buy your own socks, as long as they're white, you're good.
Yeah.
And we're going to use the money and we're going to develop you as a player.
Because
right. There's a ton of people playing the game of soccer that look really good, but don't have the technical skill sets to be able to meet the top level, or to meet even a level below that.
Right.
And so I feel at times, and I've been a TD of two different clubs in the past, and I thoroughly enjoy it, but there's too much of it where we're trying to impress parents, because parents feel, because they're spending $300 a season, which is minimal compared to other places, that we should be playing 15
games. And lots of other sports, too.
And we should be playing 20 games a season, because what are we paying for? So the adult doesn't understand development in the first place.
Right.
The adult doesn't understand that, what do you want your kid to be? So the analogy I use to them is, okay, now you're in charge of developing a building, and you have a bunch of welders. Your job is to hire this 20-story building. It's going to be all steel construction. You need a welding crew. So your choice is this. You're going to choose welders, some of whom have been training welding 4 days a week for the last 5 years of their lives. Or you're going to take welders who have been training welding once a week for maybe 6 months, then they take 3 months off, and then they do the same thing again. So now you're the foreman, and you're charged with hiring the welding group. Who would you hire? Well, I'm going to take the welders in four times a week. Why? Well, they've had more experience, more practice. Really? That's amazing. Okay, so now I don't want you to go to play. Replace the word welder with soccer player.
Mm-hmm.
You tell me who I would select as a university coach now. Your daughter or your son, or a professional team, your daughter or son, who comes from an environment where training to develop is the expectation, not the abnormality, because you want to go home to your office or to your work world or to your home to be able to tell grandma and grandpa how cool your kid was scoring 5 goals at under 8. So realistically, we have a lot of fundamental flaws that then we'll pick points now at the pinnacle, national teams, we could say university as well, for those players that come, and then lay fault with, well,
your team can't keep the ball.
Well, yeah, you're right. Sometimes we can't. But let me think, where should that have been developed?
Right.
Should I be trying to teach an 18-year-old how to knock a ball 40 yards up the pitch? Or should that already be part of her skill set?
Yeah.
Should I be able to have a player that's capable of delivering a cross with pinpoint accuracy, or at least within a plus or minus 3 or 4 yard vicinity, not trying to educate how to actually hit the ball to do that? Because right now, I'm still doing that. But it's okay to blame Bob, or Rob Gale, or you name it, Tony Fonseca, or Mr. Flores, that, wow, you guys don't know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the system has got holes in it, and I think they're trying to fill those holes in a more sensible way.
Yeah, it's a big process, though, obviously.
It's a huge process.
Yeah.
We don't, as I say, like, you can. I've been to Holland on a coach's course. You can cross. I lived in Britain for 13 years of my life. There's nowhere in Scotland further than 50 miles from an ocean. Nowhere. So if I need to get little Jimmy McSwiggin from the Northeast Orkney Islands, because I've heard he's a great little player, to come into Glasgow, that's maybe a bit more of a reach because it's boats and the whole thing.
Right, right.
But in terms of the distance and the difficulty compared to bringing Jimmy in from
Choice Land,
Yellowknife,
Yellowknife,
Yellowknife down to come to Toronto, like that's like going across three continents or 15 different countries in Europe.
Right.
So when you put things in perspective, we have lots of opportunity, and it frustrates the hell out of me when, and other people that you've talked to, when we've got a lot of the resources are here. We do have more fiscal money than, you know, relatively a society where people make a reasonable living.
We're a wealthy country.
We're a relatively wealthy country, but not everybody is within the country.
No, but
you know? And unfortunately, the ones that are maybe not as wealthy are the ones that love the game that we play.
Right. Statistically speaking.
Yeah, you have... but it's often the distance to be able to have a consistent level of high caliber competition. So your response when you comment on the high performance thing, that's been talked about for 5 years. Do I think it's positive? Yes, but it's also adding more fiscal burden.
Right.
And so again, people will tell me, well, if we want better players in Saskatchewan, that's what we've got to have. Okay, I guess, but is there what develops more players more effectively? A better coaching development program and a better mentoring program, or taking a select group of 30 players that are able to afford it, 20 players, and go and play? I don't know the answer to that. You know, because there's now the clubs, and now you have the high performance center and these centers of excellence, some of whom are clubs, some are separate.
Right.
I don't think that's a bad thing. I know SSA is having a huge thing this Saturday in Saskatoon about bylaw changes. There's people fighting in Regina about my club, well, you shouldn't be allowed because we're FC Regina and you guys don't fit.
Mm-hmm.
I've been
trying to stay out of that as much as possible.
Because it's and yet when you talk to the people inside both organizations at the technical directing level or the coaching level, who I tend to communicate more with, both groups can see value in having choice.
Mm-hmm.
Both groups have said if their program is better than ours, then people will choose.
Right.
But it's got to the point where it's become very politically driven because of personalities on both sides. You got pissed off at me, I'm pissed off at you.
Right.
We're not going to communicate. But again, you tell me you're a youth club, and you tell me you're in it for the kids. Well, be in it for the kids. And don't use, well, we feel our development model is the best. Again, give the parent the power to choose. The parent likes what you're doing in that club, they'll be awesome and they'll stick with you. If they don't like your model, they'll go to the other model.
Right.
And if they don't like that, they'll quit. So do we want that? So, you know, I think that CIS is a definite potential pathway to develop the top players. On the women's game as a developmental stage of a 28-year-old's endpoint, because most of our girls are coming in at 17, 18 to 20 years of age, 21. And again, we make this assumption that, well, you're 18 now, you should know everything. Are you crazy?
Yeah.
People are still developing their lifestyle, communication skills, work habits, and they're 45, 50 years old.
Yeah.
And you can't make the assumption because you come out of a club program at 17 that all of a sudden because you're at university you've arrived. Cristiano Ronaldo, look at him now compared to when he went to Man U at 17 from Lisbon.
He could sure do a lot of stepovers when he was 17, though.
He was fantastic, but then what he needed to learn was the when, the why, become stronger, become more game aware, be able to adjust to the tempo, the physicality, the mental strain, the duress of being a star, all of that stuff.
Right.
And he's done that very, very well,
mm-hmm.
As evidenced by the awards and stuff he's won and the recognition. So, and Messi's the same. So, I mean, those, like, we're one very small layer of several layers in Canada, but at least now the CSA is actually talking to CIS, we're trying to build the bridge where at least that communication can begin.
Right.
That says, well, CSA might say, if you guys really want to be able to be perceived as a true pathway of development, then one of the things might be, do you have a minimum 7-month season? Whether or not it's in conference or whether it's sort of a season and then a postseason, sort of concept.
Right.
These girls, we want to be able to have that they have 20 good games per season or per year.
Right.
You know,
right.
The year being, say, August, September 1st to, you know, end of May. We've talked about, do we start early? And I think that was mentioned the other day, and I said, that's not never going to fly. I mean, there's got to be a realistic sense of things.
Right. You know, I mean, you're just not part of a university campus if you're going here. I mean, you are, but May to August, it's kind of a ghost town.
Yeah,
right?
And so, even here, like, there's nobody, even preseason here, we, with all respect to the staff that I work with, because they're great people, but they're always surprised when we start preseason in mid-August. Oh, yeah, you guys are starting preseason.
Right.
It's the same thing for the football team.
Right.
And we are always ahead of the curve because our seasons are the first two up.
Right.
And it's not. That's just the reality. Yeah. I'm not saying it's good, bad,
or you're not playing in the gym, so.
But we play, you know, that's kind of the way it is. So the CIS provides a great experience for our athletes. I've met some really cool kids and women. I've seen them grow. I've seen them move forward. I've got some people now that I'm very proud of in terms of, you know, what they've done with their education and how they've maybe also got involved as coaches. We've got a number of our women help coach within Regina. I temper that with a little bit of unrealistic expectations placed upon a 19-year-old to suddenly be the one having to phone parents when they're still going to school,
right,
and they're training three nights a week.
Right, right.
Like, I mean, let's be realistic. Bring them in and show them technique, show them, you know, concept, because there's a lot of parent coaches that have never played the game to
right,
that standard.
Right, yeah, of course.
That's the value there. But, I mean, that aside, there's a lot of good things that are going on within the CIS environment, but there's also things that can be improved. So
right,
maybe rest recovery, longer season, definitely potential. More fiscal resources to maybe implement things that we'd like to be able to do. Or, you know, a community spirit that is willing to maybe invest in the team. We've got a pretty good support here, but it could be better, to be honest. Our fan base, it's okay to say, well, soccer should be way better, but when you can only draw 150 fans to a game,
yeah,
if you're the athletic director,
mostly the friends and relatives of
exactly
the kids that are players, if
you're the athletic director who's trying to make ends meet with, you know, being cut back 3% or 1.5%, making ends meet, looking at maybe staff losses, and you want me to start a what?
Yeah.
Why? You can only get 100 fans to a game or 175 fans. Then that's sad. But that's the difference between Canadian universities and the States.
Right.
Canadian university, even our best teams might get 2,000 fans, 20, like the Rams
right,
may get, when they play the Huskies, they might get up to 5,000 or 6,000 people.
Right.
But it looks like, you know, when they play at the Mosaic Stadium, it looks like there's nobody there.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's like this big cavernous place, and I mean, there's a bit of buzz, but not that great. You can get 1,500 to a flipping bowling event in the States.
Right.
You know, like it's the Big Ten bowling. There's 1,500 people screaming
right,
and drinking beer.
Right.
It's bowling. I'm
yeah,
sorry, but it's bowling. So, and I'm not, bowling, for those that do it day in and day out, probably take offense to it, but to me it's, I don't envision that as a, the same sort of, there's an athleticism to it, and there's a mental component to it, and there's a, definitely a technical.
Nobody would claim that bowling is one of the world's largest sports.
No,
right.
But
so let's.
If you're passionate about it, you would be up in arms right now if you're listening to this
right,
podcast.
Right. People are passionate about origami too.
I'm sorry I offended you if you're listening, but you know there's a lot. I just love the game. I never played as a high level player. I come from Europe. I come from Scotland.
Well, actually, you know what? Let me just introduce that a little bit, because
yeah,
since we're changing gears, and it's a good time to change gears anyway, because we didn't really start at the start, but that's
okay.
So, I don't mind that.
No, I don't know if you're recording.
No,
this
you know what? I flipped it on partway through what you were saying there. I was like, geez, I can't lose this because this is good stuff. I better get this. So I just hit record all of a sudden. Since you mentioned Rob Gale, I'll just tell you a quick little story about what he said, because we started off with, you know, how did you end up here? And he said, well, everybody from Winnipeg says they end up in Winnipeg for one of two reasons, work or a woman.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, there you go. And then he went into the story about how he met his wife, and which is a neat little story. But, I mean, I got to pose the same question to you. I mean, Regina's not a place that a lot of people end up. But then people that do end up here, they all have this, you know, some story, right?
Yeah. So how did I end up here?
Yeah, and I mean, you can throw the, you know, your soccer education into that as well.
I ended up in this place, like many people. It's not definitely been direct.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of different curves along my pathway. I was 13 when we emigrated to Canada with my parents and my sister from Scotland. We left around 75 at a time when the country was, Britain was, it actually was a, it almost started out as a joke, to be honest. The joke was that a good friend of my father's had come back. He had immigrated to Canada in the 50s, and it, both my dad had originally been come to Canada in the 50s for about a year to 2 years, and then he went back home and his buddy stayed, and he met a wife and, you know, grew up, and they had family here or whatever, or he, his wife moved over or something. Anyway, he came back from southern Ontario to visit his mom, who wasn't doing so well. And while he was in Scotland, he gave my dad a phone call. And so they came down to visit us. And so they were all sitting around the coffee table, and my dad and my mom were moaning. Thatcher was in power at the time. Interest or income taxes were ridiculous. The economy was in the tank. Unemployment was high. And Maggie wanted more and more from Scotland. And Scotland and England, I mean, as much as we like to think we get along well, we really don't when it comes to certain things, and that's definitely one. Why are we spending all this bloody money to go to London, and they never give us anything anyway, and yada, yada, yada. So at that point in the conversation, my dad's friend, Andy, said, well, you should come to Canada. And my mom said, yeah, we'll be there tomorrow. Like, ha, 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 right? So anyway, that was, if my memory serves me correctly, somewhere in the summer, late summer. So then, fast forward to 1970, end of 74, we have my parents get the tax package in, like the, you know, they get the tax package like we all get, and they go through their paperwork, and they realize that they have to still pay more money to the government, and they've already given away 45% of their income. So at that point, my mother,
like, 45%, not like 45, you know, marginal tax bracket.
No, like it was just, they've already given that much. So it was a ridiculous amount, whatever the number was. So my mother got fed up, and as most things in the family, it's often the matriarch's decisions, not the patriarch, as we like to think.
Right.
It makes the choices. So she says, that's it. I've had enough of this. We're working for nothing. We're moving to Canada. And my dad said, well, there's a few steps we have to do first.
Yeah.
So we had to go to Canada House in Glasgow. I still remember seeing the nice flowing streams in the Rockies with the big black bears poking out the salmon.
Right, right.
Chomping away. My sister and I being...
Which represents Saskatoon and Regina.
Well, exactly. Really well.
Perfectly.
So anyway, we're there. And then... we come back, my mom and dad are in this, obviously, meeting room. Then that's it. So we don't hear anything. And around, I think March, my friend's dad, Andy, had said, well, we'll sponsor you, because that was one of the parents as well, right? So, okay, fair enough. So in around March of 75-ish, we get a note from a letter in the mail from Canada House saying that you qualified for immigration to Canada. However, you have 6 months to get here. And there's a narrow window.
Right. And I mean,
so
this wasn't
the escalation then. Is,
right.
Okay. My dad, he really doesn't have a job lined up. He comes across to Ontario, where my dad, my friend's dad, or my dad's friend was based out of Hamilton. He had put him in touch with a guy up at Sudbury, Ontario, who worked with INCO, which was Nickel at the time. And so he ended up becoming a foreman. My dad was a very talented guy. He was the multi-professional career over your lifetime before the words were even developed. Tons of different things. Anyway, so he came over and he worked at Coppercliff up in Sudbury. And then in the meantime, mum's left behind with two kids to get the house listed, get the furniture on the boat that we're going to take over, get everything sort of figured out, right?
Right, right.
So August, we take a flight over to Toronto. We arrive in Toronto, and my biggest memory of Canada is twofold. One, my dad trying to find his way off of the parking lot to get down to where we're supposed to be picked up. Because we see the car going by about three times and he couldn't find the way out.
Right.
And then when we get into this car, it was a big freaking Delta 88 Oldsmobile. So
yes,
it was a big boat, right?
Uh-huh.
So Scotland, normally a lot of smaller compact cars.
Right.
So we're already like rock stars in this big flipping boat. And then I asked my dad, so where are we going to be? Where are we going tonight, Dad? And he goes, we're going home. We're going to Sudbury. How far away is that, Dad? That's about 400 miles. And I went,
What?
It's going to take us a week to get there. Because, again, thinking
right,
as
right,
a
right.
Brit does, my grandma lived 90 miles away in Glasgow from where I grew up. We were lucky if we saw her once a year.
Right, right.
Because you just didn't travel.
No.
It's different now, but you didn't then. So we'll never get there tonight. Oh, yeah, we'll be there tonight. Okay, so we got my third memory of Canada. Was going to a Husky house and ordering a hamburger and chips or French fries.
Right.
And this boat comes in and it's put on the plate. It's put on the table.
Right.
And I look at it and I go, well, this must be for the family because it's fucking huge.
Yeah.
And then she comes in with three other plates.
Right.
And I went, Mother of God, how much do people in Canada eat?
Yeah.
Well, obviously a lot.
Well, so we're cutting down all those trees
exactly.
That we need.
So that's a third thing. And then we were in Sudbury for about 2 years. I played soccer there, on a club youth team, and it was a pretty decent player. But then my dad, again, as I said, he moved around a lot. So then we felt he was part gypsy because he always would be after like 3 years. He'd come in the house and he'd be like, hey, we're moving.
Yeah.
But we're going now.
Yeah.
And when you're making little moves in Scotland, it's no big deal, right?
Right.
We move maybe the distances of 20 miles from one to the other.
Right, right.
But the inconvenience of moving, doesn't matter whether it's 1,000 or 20 miles, it's the same, right? So my parents moved around about 28 times in their time together when they were married. My dad passed away a number of years back. So like they were moving every 2 to 3 years. It was ridiculous.
Wow.
So where are we moving to now, Dad? Well, we're moving to just outside a place called Saskatoon. So my dad had taken a job with Key Lake Mining during the construction phase because he was kind of a project engineer in that particular job. So,
and what was Key Lake Mine doing outside of Saskatoon? Building stuff to ship up there?
No.
That's way up north.
No, but Key Lake Mining, the main office was in Saskatoon.
Oh, I see.
He was going to be working there and then going up to the Key Lake site. I worked up there for a couple of years in the kitchens when I was there. But anyway, going to university. So, fair enough. We bundle everything up. So it's Barnum and Bailey's Traveling Circus.
Right.
Because we have acquired some animals by this point. So, because we lived in an acreage just outside of a place called Espanola. We had about 160 acres. We made our own maple syrup. We did a bunch of stuff. So there's been a lot of good memories that I've gathered over my life of being in Canada. I hate the winters, I'll first admit it. But, I mean, there's a lot of memories. So, made maple syrup. We had cattle there, the whole thing. So we ended up, we had a Ford F-150 half ton, and we had doesn't matter what it was, but it was a big Chevy boat, anyways, an Impala. And my mom and my sister went out in the Impala, and they had a cat in a pigeon basket in the back seat. In the truck, we had three huskies in cages in the back. We had about 8 bantam chickens. We had 4 or 5 guinea pigs, a couple of rabbits. We had a bunch of pigeons. And we had this big, bloody flowering pot between my dad and I that had never flowered in its life until we started driving it with the heat. This big, beautiful pink flower. So we got these two idiots driving down the road with this menagerie of animals behind us. And people would be like, gawking as they go by. And I finally got fed up because I was about 14 by that time. I kind of got back. My dad.
That's the stage when kids get embarrassed about
my
stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to kind of look the other way and everything. Big pink flower of all things between us, right? So my dad says, stop making faces. I said, well, they're making faces. Doesn't even matter. Just look ahead. Doesn't even matter what they think. And then stopping at various motels along the way because we drove out. And the guinea
and
pigs
start. That's a fair drive.
The guinea pigs starting to squeak at 5 in the morning when the sun's coming up, or the rooster crowing and trying to get the hell out of Dodge before the rest of the happy campers wake up to.
Right.
Whatever. Anyway, so we lived in an acreage just outside of Saskatoon.
Which direction, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I lived around Bradwell, so
okay.
We were there. So we lived in that area. Got to know a local farmer. He had an acreage that we rented from him. Great guy. Then I went to finish high school in Allen, Saskatchewan, mm-hmm. and then I went to the U of S. And my original interest was I played soccer. I loved the game, but that wasn't. Like, I didn't see, when I went to Saskatoon, didn't see sort of soccer in my path at that time. Like, I loved the game,
still do,
but anyway, obviously. But I did want to be a vet at one point, so I went to College Vet Culture in the U of S, one of the best in the country. Had great memories there, met some great people. But along the way, as I was getting into my sort of fourth, I graduated, went down to Swift Current, worked for 2 years with Cargill down there at Nutrita Feed Plant. And started coaching a little bit there, just in the community. And then I came back to Saskatoon.
Sorry, what years were you there?
I was there in 84, 85.
Oh, okay. I wasn't quite in the city yet.
Yeah,
so
we
lived, you know where Success is?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I was living and going to elementary school. And I started in high school in 87.
And then I went back to Saskatoon. And I was working at a feed lab there, testing. And I was basically working with cattle producers around Saskatchewan, dairy producers, hog producers, because I had an animal science background. So I met a fellow, a good friend of mine, one of my mentors on the educational side, who was working at the Prairie Swine Center in Saskatoon. And his boy was just starting to play. He was like 5 or 6. And we were chatting away, and he goes, "Well, you seem to know a bit about the game. Why don't you come and help me?" I said, "Okay, sure, whatever, it'll be fun." So that was about 26 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I first got into coaching. And as I say, you get bit by the bug. And I just really enjoy, and I still do to this day, trying to provide information, training sessions to make players better than they were the day before. Very cliche, I know, but that's the reality for most of us. And by doing that, just seeing kind of their sort of confidence grow, smiles in the faces when they achieve something they didn't think they could. So that was kind of where my path started. And then I was playing at the time on a men's team in Saskatoon, and a lot of those guys were coaching within clubs in Saskatoon. And I was tying my boots up one day, and I made a statement about, "Yeah, I just started coaching these rec kids, but they're under 6s and they're under 7s. It'd be nice to maybe coach a team where you can actually do some stuff with them." And so the one guy, a couple of weeks later, says, "Well,
be careful what you wish for."
Yeah, the guy says, "Well, actually, we're looking for a coach for our 14 boys team, first division team." And okay, not having a clue what that meant. Well, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And when I still, every once in a while, I'll mentally see myself running sessions and how much of a disservice I did to those boys.
Wow.
Because, you know,
but when you're just learning, right?
Yeah, but because, again, the impression then, again, is not so much. And that's why I'm a little bit protective of our players that are the same age as myself, who are willing to give back to the community, and then suddenly expected to be the manager, coach, parent, and everything at one time.
Mm-hmm.
No chance.
Okay.
So I had that. I started with this team. But there was a gentleman who I got to know through my association with the team, whose son was on the team. But he was also the city manager of Saskatoon at the time. Larry Olenberger is his name. And he was an absolutely fantastic mentor, his good friend. We don't see each other that much, but it's one of those things when you see them, it's like,
right,
you've never left type thing.
Yeah.
And he really helped me out a lot on dealing with sort of the less desirable elements of coaching, which is dealing with the frustrated, you know, parental member that doesn't understand why their son's not playing, or doesn't understand why we need to train so much,
mm-hmm.
or why we need to travel as a team, and why we can't stay, why we're not going shopping at a tournament, you know, those type of things. So anyway, they got to a point where I was coaching the team. They split in two in the winter, and I was training both teams. Working with both teams.
Is that because of player numbers? Like, there were just too
many?
Yeah,
it was, well, it was indoors, and it was, like, in gyms. It wasn't.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
So, like, we split them in two, and, you know, ended up where the one team ended up going to provincials that winter, whereas the other team, who had midway through the season been ahead of the team that went, suddenly the one team had to squeak into the last round to be able to qualify for provincials.
Oh.
And the team that was already there was, like, sitting in second. So the team that snuck in started winning every game, and the team that was in second lost every game. So they didn't get a chance to go because they were only going to take the top three of the five,
or
top two. So then, following that, I had parents on the team that got knocked out said, we'd like to meet with you. I said, okay, why? Because, well, we think that you favored the other team more so than our boys, and that you maybe even threw the game in the game, because to get into the final round, they played each other.
Okay.
And so the one team had to win. The other team didn't matter. They were already in that last group.
Right.
But they needed to win.
Right.
And they did win. And the goal was scored with about a minute left in the game, top corner from about 30 yards out. Like, that's something that I definitely planned. You know, like, I planned all that. I planned all that.
Of course, you know, you did. Of course, because we all know that that's how it works.
Exactly. So it's like it's in movies, maybe. But
I don't even think there.
I was livid, and, you know, I'm young, I'm Scots, so I've got a temper already, and I remember going and talking to Larry and saying, hey, this is absolute crap. He goes, Bob, he says, I agree with you first and foremost, however, here's what you need to do. So along the way, it's not always through sport that you get help.
Mm.
It's through many other facets of your life, if you're willing to look for it, ask, or whatever. I said, well, what should I do?
And he says, accept it if it's offered.
Exactly. He says, well, what you need to do first and foremost is don't go in and attack. Just listen and write notes. Take a book, write notes. Okay. And then reflect on what you've heard, and then provide responses to their statements. Otherwise, it becomes emotional, and otherwise, then nothing gets achieved.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. So I did that. And at that moment, I found how ludicrous is one word, biased would be another word, and passionate for their children is also another element that people can be when their child doesn't gain the perceived advantage that they were hoping for them.
Right.
And in society now, with helicopter parents and all of the stigmas that go with that, it's becoming worse, not better.
Right.
We are fearful of a society, and I genuinely feel that's part of Canada's problem in soccer, is that we don't have enough players who really know how tough it is.
Right.
If you take a Mexican boy, and he's been living in Mexico City, and maybe a less desired, because most times it's not the affluent kids.
Right, right.
You look at, again, professional sports in North America. It's the kid coming out of maybe a tougher neighborhood, ghetto,
right,
you know, whatever word you want to put it. If you've never had to struggle. So I feel that that's partly why ignoring the recent group of individuals who have come to Canada and calling it home, to put a price point above them, to not be able to see that same burning desire.
Right.
It's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough to tell a player, you need to be training like 5 hours a week on your own. You need to be doing this. You need to juggle a ball every day. Yes, coach. Yes, coach. Yeah, okay, coach. Whatever, coach. Yeah. And then see them hop into their nice SUV going to their multi-$1,000 home.
Right.
Because really what they don't, I don't feel that, it's not that I want to see everybody poor to play soccer, but I don't think there's an appreciation of how fortunate we really are,
right,
and how hard. And I feel that we're doing a tremendous disservice to kids when we don't let them hear the word no, that we don't let them fail, because we're supposedly protecting them. Protecting them from what? So that the first job they get is the time they're fired? That's the first time you want to hear them?
From never having a smile not on their pretty little faces.
Exactly. You know? So you know, so anyway, that was a great moment for me, was to be able to have someone there to guide me at that moment, because I know a lot of young coaches who quit the game because of instances like that.
Right, right.
and a lot of referees who quit the game because of instances like
it's
that.
It's stressful.
And, you know, and it's more than stressful. I mean, they're basically, it's accusational, they're attacking your personal beliefs, your values, I believe strongly in fairness and trying my best to be fair. My biggest struggle with this team is selecting my 18 players every weekend. Because I got 28 women on the team, and they're all trying this summer, just doing better that day or better that week of training, or more able to handle the team that we're going to play against tactically, whatever. There's a variety of different reasons, but it's still difficult to look a player in the eyes and say, "You're not dressing this weekend."
Yeah.
You're in a trap.
In the moment when all the parents had the pitchforks out, what was the ultimate resolution?
Resolution was that I basically confronted their problem. I said respectfully, everybody's entitled to your opinion, but yours is full of shit. I said that here's the reasons why. I said I find it interesting that I'm the one to blame when your boys come in here immediately following the team that's left that you said I favor with the same coach, running exactly the same practice, but yet it takes your boys 20 minutes to get focused where those boys come in right away and they're ready to work. Your guys are swinging off the basketball hoops, pissing about with the ball, crashing balls everywhere, laugh, giggle, not as much intent to try and be successful. This other group is. So that's my fault. It's my fault that your boys are coming to practice ill-prepared mentally to be great players. That's my fault.
And how did they take that?
Well, no, we're not saying it's all you're saying. No, you just told me that. Here's your notes. This is what you said. I said, so here's the deal. I said, if you don't want me to coach your team, no problem. I won't coach your team. I said, but don't ever accuse me of ever being favoritism. Don't ever accuse me of throwing a game. Because the next time you do, I'll put you through that window.
Well, but I thought your mentor said that it wasn't supposed to be
but that was at the end.
Confrontational.
No, at the end.
Right.
It wasn't confrontational because I didn't say I'm going to put you through that window.
Right.
I just said if you do it again. So I'm giving you an option. It's your choice. So realistically, I just said, and that was at that point, I think the following year, I think I just kind of backed away for a little while. And then I got involved at this around that time, the provincial program, started coaching on the women's side there. It wasn't any reason for it. It was just they needed a coach, and they said, "Would you want to do a women's team?" And I went, "No, I don't care. And athletes are athletes to me." So that was a great, tremendous learning curve because you think you're doing okay because your team that 14 boys team, they won the silver medal at provincials, whatever that means. But I mean, they had a decent year.
Right.
But again, as I say, there was a lot of things that I do today that I wasn't even my planet.
Right, right.
Because over time, and you go for certification. So I got into coaching. I said, well, if I'm going to do this for a while, and if I enjoy it, I better try and educate myself to be better at it. So now, a number of years back, but I got my national B license. So mm-hmm. Rob's got his A. Mm-hmm. He's got his UEFA as well. So I'm now looking at taking a course this upcoming year, whether it's in the NSCA or with the CSA. I don't know yet, but I'm looking into that. Because I think, again, I do a lot of reading. I think most good people do. It's not just the paper you have in your wall or in your room, but I subscribe to 3 different websites. I'm always reading. I've got Ferguson and Mourinho's books. I've got, I do a lot of that. And, I'm not perfect by any stretch. I make as many errors as I do successes. But I think at the end of it, you're always trying to find better ways of imparting information to your players that engages them, keeps them active, makes it enjoyable, and at the same time makes them better.
Right.
Rather than boring, mundane, I hate being here, because again, that drives people away from a sport that is the world's game.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer that this is the game. I get annoyed in Canada. I was interviewed when Canada hosted the U20 Men's World Cup.
2007.
Yeah.
Just so, before TFC started.
Yeah.
Sorry, maybe that was 2006 then.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, I hosted it. And I can't remember the year, obviously, top of that. And I was phoned by SAS Soccer, would you do a phone interview on the radio? Sure. Whatever, nobody else? Well, no, but you like to talk and you're good at it.
You like to talk.
Okay, whatever. Okay.
You're going to fill some airtime. Is that what they were saying?
Yeah. So Drew Remenda, the Drew Remenda show, right? So Drew Remenda Hi, Bob. It's Drew Remender here. We'll be on with you right away. Here's kind of the gist. We want to get your thoughts and impressions around the World Cup. U20 men, you know, coming to Canada. You know, got us. Yeah, awesome, Drew. No problem. So, goes off air. You can hear him. Then he comes back on. We're with Bob Maltman, provincial coach and CEO within SAS Soccer, fairly well known in the Regina community. Bob, great to have you on air. Well, thanks very much, Drew. So, Bob, and nothing but negatives. So, Bob, what do you think about Canada with the World Cup? I mean, like, how is it a surprise to you Canada's hosting the World Cup when so few people play the game in Canada? And I went, oh, it's going to be one of those, is it? I said, okay. All right, no problem. I said, well, no, Drew, it doesn't really surprise me. I said, but what might surprise you is that Canada actually has the most participants of any sport in this country. And it has been that way for about the last 4 years. Soccer registrants in this country exceed hockey and every other sport that Canada plays. So for you to tell me that it's not popular, I would tend to refute that point. And also, Canada does a tremendous job of providing quality product, entertainment, volunteerism, and all of the various things that people look for when they're bringing a world stage event.
Right.
Okay. Well, what do you feel for like with soccer when the game is more solo scoring and things like that and something else? And I just kind of, in my own little way, I kind of lost it on him. I just said, listen, what do you tell people that say that the game is, it's low score or boring? I said, nothing. I said, nothing I'd say on the air tonight is going to change somebody's mind. If they believe the game is boring, I said, I'll be honest, I think baseball is as boring as all get out. I said, but there's a ton of people who disagree with me and go to baseball games.
Different strokes for me, different folks.
It's a different game, it's a different type of game. But what I would say to them is to appreciate the immense amount of talent and skill it takes to be able to run 10 to 12 kilometers in a game under the duress of somebody kicking you all day, under 30-degree weather, being able to control a ball that was hit to you 70 yards away with precision pinpoint accuracy to, with one touch, knock a ball in and put a game winner in the 90th minute of a game with no stoppages other than halftime. You name me any other sport in this country that does that. Oh, that's right. There is none. I said, so that's what I would say to the person who doesn't appreciate the game. I said, appreciate the athleticism required to do that job, just like they would expect me to appreciate how good Sidney Crosby or Wayne Gretzky is in their sport.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, well that's good. Thanks, Bob. So like people say it's a boring game because it's so low scoring. Like what would you say to that? I went, again, to add to my previous comment, perhaps if we did what CFL does and multiplied every goal by 7 points, then all of a sudden it might become a hell of a game. It's because the last time I checked, you, if the Rough Riders win 14-7, people walk out of that stadium with smiles from ear to ear, thinking the Riders had a cracker of a game.
Yeah, but it was really 2-1.
But it was really 2-1. And there's a tremendous number of games, Drew, that are 2-1 games.
Well, thanks very much, Bob. We've got to go now. Up next is Mike McCullough with the Riders.
Oh, that would be good. Click, asshole. So, anyway, it's like, I just went, we fight culturally that stigma, which is changing, and that's the exciting
thing. Well, I think it is changing.
Fast forward now to, that's 8 years ago. We've had several successes, Women's World Cup, the U19 World Cup.
Under-20 Women's World Cup was the year before, yeah.
The 19s, the 20s, now the Women's World Cup, exceeding their own expectations by about 35% in terms of profit revenues, to the country. Now, my goal would be then to CSA buck up and then start maybe making sure that your youth teams have the funding to be able to do the work they need to do to go and be the players that you want them to be.
Yeah.
That the provincial teams, if you see that pathway as their way in, then, or the clubs or whatever, look at that money and say, well, if we expected $350 million and we got $493, what are we going to do with that extra $145 that's really gravy? Mm-hmm. How can we turn that and make it a multiplier effect and turn it into something really positive?
Right.
What can we do with that money? Not be stupid about it, but what can we do with it?
Yeah.
And I think if we can do that, maybe in 5 years, 6 years, we're seeing the success of that seed that was sown for the Women's World Cup, because we know the last time there was an influx of female, young female athletes, female players exceed male players in Canada, but it was huge after the first World Cup here with the U20s and U19s. And so, like for me, the coaching side of it, like I got into, say, the B license, then I started coaching provincially, had a great opportunity again through soccer to see other parts of the country that I otherwise might not have.
Right.
I've been to every province with the exception of Northwest Territory, like Northwest, I can't remember the names, but Northwest, I haven't been to Yukon through soccer, but my parents moved there when I started university, so I've been up there for a summer. I've been to...
Because, of course, I had to move.
Yeah, again, because I was working with a different company. which was a great growth experience for me because I was 17, just turned 17 starting university, so I was a year ahead age-wise, and my parents moved to Yukon that same year, that summer, so I'm on my own now.
Right.
And stuff to go home for the weekend.
Yeah.
So
sink or swim, I guess.
That was a good thing for me. I've been to Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, Quebec, Ontario, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, BC. I've not been yet been to PEI, New Brunswick, all through the sport. So for someone who's come to this country and be able to say that I've seen not all the country, because I mean you see the field, you see the venue,
a big chunk of it though.
But you've been to regions of the country, because again I would defy them to say, well yeah, I saw New Brunswick, saw Nova Scotia. No, I've seen Halifax,
seen
a little bit of it, but we took our team last season, preseason, down to Acadia.
So we went and played
in Acadia, then we went up to Cape Breton, and they were really hospitable there. Great. And again, those are the memories I'm trying to create for my women and this team, because like our players, is that you walk away with those memories and you'll always have those. You will forget the scores. Win or lose, you'll forget the results. You'll remember the hotel room, what happened in the bus, you'll remember the flight home or the difficulty to get home. You'll remember maybe the party or two that you went to, the team camaraderie in our team room, all of that. The scores, you'll remember the ones that really stood out. You know, if you win a medal, you get to nationals, whatever. But most of it is more about the memories. So if we can create that. So 2013, so we'll go back and jump ahead.
That's okay.
So I came to, I was working, went to university, coached, and then I moved to Swift Current for about 2 years. And then I came back, and then that's when I really started. No, it's when I came back. So I was coaching when I came back. And then around 95, I had my own business for a little while. And then I was involved in the livestock sector and doing nutritional services, linear programming to provide, you know, these cost rations, did some cost formula, started my own consulting business. And part of my job at that time was to write curriculum for SIAS at the time, now SAS Polytechnic, because they used to have a livestock program in Regina.
Right.
And I wrote a nutrition course for beef cattle production. And then they said, well, do you want to teach it? I said, sure. So that was kind of where I got into the teaching side. So I was an adult educator for SIAS from 95 to 98. And then I left for a couple of years and then came back and was there till about 2007, 2008. And, 2011. And so full-time, then went to part-time because this job opened up as a part-time honorarium position, so SIAS worked really well to be able to do both.
Right.
And then eventually my family moved down, my wife and I and our kids moved down here in 95, 96, summer of 96, or spring of 96, and we've been here ever since. And then the university opened up, as I say, around 2007, and then in 2012 it turned full-time.
Right.
But in the meantime, I was also in 2011 working as a TD and PA plus working with ISTM. So I was driving up and down the highway.
You put a lot of kilometers on.
I was about 47,000 that year.
Wow.
But I really enjoyed the PA community and I liked it. This turned full time and I just enjoy this environment and you know, the competitiveness and the, you know, the expectations and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of my story. As I say, I'm the first one to profess. I never really played at a professional level. I can play the game. I'm not bad as a player, but I haven't really played for a while. I believe I am a student of the game. I think like a lot of people that are passionate about anything do. I think they're always looking for better ways. I think they're always reading, looking at maybe other people from other walks, leadership, things that, you know, the job I'm in now, where you're trying to maybe pick up a glimmer, like Sir Alex's most recent, you know, book out. I read his other ones, Mourinho's, both his own biography plus those that have been written about him. Van Gaal, a bit stuff on him. And not that those are my idols, but I think they're good coaches and they're good managers of people, particularly Ferguson. I mean, you don't win as much as he's done.
He must know something.
I think he does. And I mean, in that cauldron every day where winning is the be-all and the end-all and the millions that are being spent, you have to do something pretty special to work with the staff to get the best out of your players, because it's not all by him. He's the first to admit it. So I think, again, like for me, my path has been a little bit convoluted to get to where I am today. People are surprised that I have an animal science degree and that I went through college of agriculture. What? You're a soccer coach. Or when I was doing that, and they went, well, how come you're going to coach a soccer team at the university? But it's more sort of the experiences you've had and, you know, what your philosophy is. I think it's what sold people here. We try again to best. I don't think we're necessarily where we want to be, yet. But we're trying to integrate more within the local community. We invite younger players to train with us in the off season, and not so much as a means in my mind, because I've been that youth coach. Sometimes it's difficult to keep a kid at 14, 15. That's a funny age.
Everybody says that.
Where they start to maybe see that the light's dimming in soccer and other things are opening. And for us, this brief.
Now I wish this was video, not
this,
audio.
This brief was lunch room. It's been brought to you, buddy. But you know that if I can, through maybe allowing those kids a chance to come and train with a senior player and beside them, my goal here is to create a women's league for Regina, not for the UR, but Regina in the off season to help us overcome some barriers that we have because of environmental conditions.
Yeah.
Compared to UBC, Trinity Western, UFV, Victoria, can play, you know, pretty much year round.
I mean, I did some basketball, played basketball, high school basketball. And then when I came here for university, you know, there was the, I forget what they call it, Spring League, right, for basketball. Is that what you're kind of talking about, too? Like an off-season women's league kind of thing?
You know, and just to, but they have a women's league here, but it's to produce a quality. We used to play in the league, and It was a no-win situation.
Right.
Because our team was just coming out of a season where we're used to working at a very high standard.
Right.
We go into a league, and then maybe the team that's in there is more, their focus is more maybe enjoyment of exercise and being together and going around. And now all of a sudden you're playing a bunch of young racehorses that are wanting to win.
Right.
So some results were very lopsided, like 10, 12, 13, nothing games.
Right.
And
nobody really enjoys
there's nobody wins in that situation.
Yeah.
So we're trying to see if we can work with the RSA on maybe creating our team into maybe two or three, four clusters, and then former alumni, under 18s that, you know, are not prevented from playing their own youth program.
Right, right.
But can be added in for those that are really motivated, maybe looking at university or going to college or whatever. And there's maybe only two or three in each team. And then go into your U16 player, and it's really good. And then say, right, now we've got four teams that are 8 to 10 players, 9 players, 12 players in a team.
Right.
Playing 8v8 or full field, depending on the situation, the volume of players. And then making it like on a Sunday afternoon so the mums and daughters and they can come out and have little ball girls walk in and make it an experience that maybe creates that incentive that a 14-year-old goes, well, shit, she's only a year older than me. How do I want to be here.
Yeah.
I want to play.
Yeah.
You know, and if that inspires in our own little way, it's our way of maybe helping contribute to not only the university fabric or the Regina fabric within the sport, but it's also, you know, now maybe creates a greater following of our team when we're playing in our season. Maybe
instead of 150 fans,
you might have 200.
More.
Like we've had the biggest crowd we had was 650 when we played in 2012. We qualified for Final Four, which is the first time ever, and we played the Huskies here. That was awesome. We went to PKs. They scored a goal in the dying seconds of the regular time. No score in, you know, overtime, extra time, and then we ended up PKs. And to see that many people run the field, and your players kind of surrounded by fans and,
right.
and the support of the other athletic teams. It was really a really cool moment for me.
Neat.
It was really neat. So, I mean, I don't think while the moments are different, I think when you know any coach sees their athletes you know reach their potential or achieve something or not, just fail. I think the emotions are the same. I think you're mm-hmm. you're sad for them emotionally because they're great kids, they're great people, and they work so hard. But you're also maybe saying, well, the other team also did a lot of that same thing. You know, sometimes luck is chance, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's preparation, hard work comes together is luck, right? And the other thing is that you know you also have that same sort of emotional playing when your team succeeds in something because it's like you're happy for them, you know, and you're like, I mean, yeah, you're proud of the accomplishments your team has done and you've had a role in that, but you're just happy to see them run around and do their things. But I'm equally as proud of our 9 academic All-Canadians over the average. I'm very proud of this university that we're the only school in the entire country that provides tuition for them.
Right.
So that we're rewarding excellence in the classroom because they know the sacrifice these girls or these young men and women make to play the sport and represent their university.
Right.
That's their way, the university's way. But to think of our 14,500 student body is the only school that does that, that's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it is very impressive. And so I'm proud of a lot of things. I think that the support that this university provides to me financially, to be able to do the things that I want to do in my life and with our family, to see, as I said earlier, young women just kind of grow and mature. You know, it's tough to beat that. You know, it's pretty cool.
That's neat. Give me. So I was by, now was that in September when you had Carmelina Moscato?
Yeah, Carmelina.
Yeah. And I mean, you were talking earlier about the whole fundraising aspect of what you need to do. So obviously that had something to do with that. But
it costs us more than we made.
So oh, is that right? No, that's
okay.
Too bad.
That's okay.
No, I mean, I'm just, whenever there's, you know, somebody of a national profile, try and get out there and maybe drag one of my kids, even though they're not soccer players or whatever. But no, I'm interested in what the players on your team thought about what she said and her whole presentation and whether or not you guys debriefed that and kind of what came out of that.
Well,
because,
the Carm, again, this is a great example of Carm arriving here in the first place is a great example of having people around you through their networks and their passions can lead to this. Because Robbie Coffrey is a very good friend of Carm's. Both went to Wisconsin around the same time, and because of his connections, was able to discuss. She was interested, and then I took over. You know, and then I took the phone calls and said, "Well, you know, kind of what sort of price point are you looking at?" And she took the minimum amount per day versus what she could have. So she was trying to provide support to our team, and you know. Friendship with Rob is maybe a sort of a means of sort of providing some help for the program. So we had a greater experience than simply the presentation because Carm also ran a training session for our team and talked to our team at that moment or during that. And it's always kind of cool. And then talked to us. Like we went for meals with her, and she shared kind of a little bit of the insight to the sort of the training development of the national women's team, and how good John Herbin really is, and what he did for her, and some of the things that he brought in that she said, you know, you might want to think about here. And so, I mean, you pick up things as a coach. So it wasn't just solely the players that you know I found value in having Carm here. It was just to have someone who's made the world level. Represent her country, and also to be able to find out from her like the hardships, the sacrifices, the ups and downs that she's experienced in her career, including the World Cup, because she didn't get to play as much. And
of course,
she plays in the same position that Sesselman plays.
Right,
Sesselman didn't really have a standout tournament. And so, of course, she could have been very bitter about that, but yet she really showed a lot of maturity, professionalism, and just showed the quality of character that Carmen really is. And I've now got her, you know, as a friend, and that's a tremendous boost and benefit for me. Such a great orator and ability to communicate as a coach, as well as to see her ability to share a story in a very humble manner, which is one of the things that I've heard, no matter who I talk to, about her, which can't be said about every national / professional player that comes to do presentations. You know? And so she is, I would recommend her to any group that wanted to. We also had made arrangements for her to work with the U18 national PA team that was going to nationals. I've got a couple of one of the daughters of the coach, who's a good friend of mine. I got to know him through PA, and before that even, because I coached his daughters in provincial teams, and we both have played here, and the third one we're hoping to bring down here too. They were coming down to get some games in, and I said, well, would you be interested in, it's going to cost you a bit of money, but would you be interested in having Carm come out and work with your players? And he wasn't too sure about, well, what she's going to do and stuff. I said, well, trust me, she'll be all
right.
So she came in, and he said, those girls, like his girls, just were absolutely amazed, you know, I wouldn't say awestruck's the right word, but certainly just like big eyes about, here's a national team player who's playing professionally, now in Australia playing, who's helping me out. And just to see how she could control and move the ball and the tempo and the precision and the quality of her, the way her, you know, she opened up her body. And but then to us as coaches, she would say it, like, Bergman spent 2 years just teaching us to get out of bad habits. Over and over and over, which a lot of our players do. I watch them all day. And youth players are worse. So to have somebody come in, not simply the same coach telling them the same thing, is always a nice feature. And you can always be, because I've done it, like I, as I say, I did a little 13-year-old girls course or session the other night, and the coach got back and said that the girls loved it and said we'd have Bob back anytime and da-da-da. Well, of course, like, you walk in there, you're always a hero, because they don't know you, so they're going to work harder because they don't know you. And I mean, that's always the nice thing of being, like, it's like being the grandparent. You can spoil the shit out of the kid because you can wave at the door and say, well, we'll see you later. And everybody thinks you're great. So you walk away. That was awesome. And then just to hear during the conversation with Derek, who I thought did a really good job of sort of, you know, made it a really, we always wanted it to be informal. I did a lot of legwork in behind it. Rakesh Kapila supported a lot with, you know, helping us create like the pick-a-tip thing and all that. We wanted it to be something where anybody that came walked away going, wow, that was awesome, like really, really good information. And for the young kids, like, there's a little girl, Caitlin Erickson and Ashton Erickson, play FC Regina, that I was involved with. We run a little kids development program here, we call it Kicks and Giggles and Soccer School with a K. And the women help out with that, and it's my way of trying to get them into coaching at the same time as making limited money. We might make $1,500 on it. But at the end of it, it's about that. And to have those little kids now in FC who still work with us on occasion, but time permitting, but to come in and see that, wow, there's a national team player, a picture with her, and she signed my autograph on the picture. That's going to go on some kid's wall now, and that's going to be their goal. You know, so to know that for any athlete, I think that's the pinnacle, to know that they do have a potential influence.
And that brings us to the end of episode 63. Thanks for listening, and of course, thanks to Bob for joining us today. We'll be back with more episodes in our Focus on Saskatchewan series soon, so until then, take care.